from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday. Hollywood has a way of taking historical figures and making them bigger than life, perfect beings that embody heroism and represent everything we want to be. Walt Disney's version of Davy Crockett is no exception. When Fess Parker donned a coonskin cap in the 1950s, America couldn't get enough of the frontier hero. But in reality, Davy Crockett was a much more complex man. Bob Thompson hit the road to find the real Davy Crockett. He discovered the man's Tennessee roots, examined his roller coaster career as a U.S. congressman, and ended his journey at the Alamo on the 175th anniversary of that epic battle. We'll talk to him about his new book, Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett, and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. He's been called the King of the Wild Frontier, a man who wields a tall musket and wrestles bears. We've seen him portrayed on the big and small screens by Fess Parker, John Wayne, and even Billy Bob Thornton. But the truth is, Davy, or David Crockett, as he preferred being called, spent his life inventing his own mythology with the hopes of escaping poverty and achieving political fame. Things didn't quite work out as he had planned. His congressional career ended in failure, and he set out west in search of cheap land and a second chance. At the age of 49, he found himself on the losing side of a conflict with Santa Anna's Mexican army at the Alamo, and he gave his life at the battle that defined Texas, first as a nation and then as a state. So, who is the real Davy Crockett? And where does myth intersect with fact? Bob Thompson hit the road to find out. He was a longtime feature writer for the Washington Post and editor of the Sunday magazine there. His first book is called Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. You can join the conversation. The phone number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. You can also chime in on Facebook and Twitter. Bob Thompson joins us from a studio today in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks, Terry.
So, Bob, I want to start off with the looming question, why Davy Crockett? I mean, of all the American mythical figures, Daniel Boone, Kit Carson, Lewis and Clark, what captivated you most about Davy Crockett?
Well, let me answer that in two different ways, and let me start by saying that Crockett himself is an extraordinarily interesting man, real man, who represents a lot of things that were essential in American history at the time he lived. He was a poor frontiersman who was striving to raise himself up. He kept moving west. He fought Indians. And then he got involved in politics and became one of the nation's first true celebrities. He wasn't a celebrity so much for what he did, but because he represented frontiersmen. And he was hugely famous. Then he had this fantastic afterlife, which we'll get into more later, where he became a legend and the legend changed and shifted over time. But that's a little secondary for me. What happened to me was that when my daughter was 4 years old, we played her a version of The Ballad of Davy Crockett. We were taking a car trip and we had a tape by a folk singer named Burl Ives singing a lovely version of it. And we got to the end of the tape, which was the last song on the tape, and Lizzie said, "Play that song again." And about a year and a half later, she was done with her Davy Crockett face, during which time the whole family learned an enormous amount about Davy. I didn't know anything about him. I had missed the Disney Crockett craze. And Lizzie moved on, but I remained fascinated for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier with this character who was fascinating in his real life and even more fascinating in the metamorphosis of his legend.
Bob, your book has a wonderful road trip feel to it, and you could have been like many other researchers of Davy Crockett. You could be sitting in libraries at the University of Texas or in Washington, D.C. Instead, you got in your car and you retraced the steps of Crockett. Why that approach to understanding more about Davy?
Well, the other approach has been done. I don't think anybody's done it perfectly, but it's been done, and there's not a whole lot more about Crockett to be learned in the archives. I did some of that, but the real reason is I'm trained as a journalist, not a historian. I went to graduate school in history, but dropped out after 3 weeks. And journalism, I was late to the reporting end of journalism. I started as an editor. And what I discovered was that when you just go out on the road, fantastic things happen that you don't expect. And the idea here was to go wherever Crockett had gone and talk to the many people who are still deeply engaged in his story one way or another, whether as pure fans or park rangers or historians or reenactors or, in some cases, people who'd written plays about Davy. Most of the people I met along the way I didn't know about before I left, so there was a wonderful kind of serendipity to it. And the other reason the road trip worked is that one of the things I was most interested in is the variation between legends and versions of Davy's story. And so wherever I went, I got something that was a little different from where I'd been before.
So in your travels, what did you find out about the early life of Davy Crockett? You mentioned earlier that he, his entire life, he was plagued by poverty and financial woes, and that seemed to get off at an early start with Davy. At one point, he was indentured to pay off some of his father's debts. Is that correct?
That is. The poverty starts before that. One of the things I learned about him is that the people in East Tennessee who claim Crockett as their own, rightly so, because he spent half his life there when he was growing up, they feel that they've been left out of the story a little bit because it often starts later on as he's moved west and gotten into politics. But it's an enormously important part of shaping him. His father was a man who had tried a number of things. He was, when Davy was growing up, a tavern keeper at what one of my sources called a third-rate tavern in Morristown, Tennessee. And they had a bunch of kids and no money, and Davy's father drank a fair amount, so that took up money. And when Davy was 12 years old, his father basically hired him out on a cattle drive. This was not entirely uncommon, but it was just a way to send him out and make a little bit of money, but also to keep from having to feed him. So he helped a guy drive cattle to Virginia, then he came back, and then he ran away from home after a conflict with his father, and got as far as Baltimore, which in 1800, which is when this was, that's an amazing trip for a teenager. He got as far as the Baltimore Harbor. He almost went away to sea. He met a captain of one of the ships who offered him a place, and the man he was traveling with essentially prevented him from going. Otherwise, we'd never have heard of him. When he got back off that trip, he was about 16, and his father had accumulated a lot of debts, and he worked various places to pay them back. And eventually he got married and went out on his own and started moving west. And each time he moved, it was looking for some place that would give him a better start.
You talk about marriage. Davy wasn't very successful at marriage or women either. It depends on which way you look at it, I suppose. He was married a total of three times, correct?
No, just twice.
Twice, okay.
He had three young women who he fell in love with before he married the third one. That was Polly Crockett, who was the wife who's portrayed in the Disney movie. And he and Polly were together until 1815, when Polly died, which is a whole other story. At that point, they had three children, and David fairly quickly married a widow with children of her own as a way of kind of joining forces and recreating a family that would help him take care of the children, among other things.
And that was Elizabeth Patton. She was trying to sort of keep him at home at certain points, wasn't he? I mean, Davy always had sort of this wanderlust itch about him.
Yes, nobody was ever able to keep Davy at home. Let me back up to Polly there. 200 years ago, this summer, they were living near Winchester, Tennessee, in a beautiful valley on a little farm which he had rented, and where you can go today and still see what the local people say is a well that he dug. And he was probably already getting into a little debt, and he was getting a little itchy, but it was pretty idyllic. And then along came the Creek War, and David volunteered, absolutely against the will of Polly, who was living in a wilderness situation where she didn't know anybody. She had, at that point, two small children, and she really did not want him to go. And he went anyway. And there was an argument that the men of that area had to go and fight the Creeks, because otherwise who would stop them? And that's the argument he gave. But that's undermined a little bit by the fact that after his enlistment was up, he came back for a while, and then he enlisted again. And by that time, the Creek War was over, and we were fighting the British. And Davy just said he had a hankering to go fight some British, and left Polly again. By the time he came back, there's a little unclearness about this. She died either before he got back or shortly after he got back. And nobody knows precisely why, but being left alone in the wilderness for an extended period of time, it could not have helped.
And then Davy is home alone with three children, and that's where he meets Elizabeth Patton and decides that...
He meets Elizabeth, and yes, they decide to get together. And she tries to keep him at home in a different way, although I'm sure he was a part of this. She came with a little money. Her family was middle class, and I've forgotten the exact total, but she had enough money to and some land to change their prospects. And they moved west to a place called Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, which is one of my favorite places to visit. And there they started a mill complex, a grist mill, a powder mill, and a distillery, all the essentials for the frontier. And they built that up, and it looked very promising, and David got elected to the state legislature. And he went off, and about 3 weeks after he got there, I'm not sure the exact number, but it's a very short time, he got word from home that a huge flood had completely wiped out his mill complex. So first of all, he hadn't stayed home anyway, even though Elizabeth wanted him to. And secondly, they then had to pick up and move elsewhere because they were again in debt.
You mentioned around this point, Davy Crockett became a member of the Tennessee legislature. What spurred Crockett's political ambitions?
He was a sociable guy, and he had a great sense of humor. And he discovered that this would work in local politics. There's a sort of long and complicated narrative of various small local political jobs he had. And I think essentially it was he was not a good farmer. He was constantly in debt. And this turned out to be something that he was good at. And so he was good at it, good enough at it to get elected to the Tennessee legislature for a couple of terms. And then after failing once, he was good enough to get elected to Congress.
I want to talk about Davy Crockett's congressional career, but I want to take a break real quick. Bob Thompson,
sure,
is the author of Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. You can join the conversation. Give us a call, 801-585-WEST. That number again, 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. We're talking to Bob Thompson. He's the author of Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. Again, give us a call, 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter. Bob, before the break, we were talking about just getting into Davy Crockett's congressional career. He was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1827. Talk about what Davy saw when he got to Washington and how he fit into the complex political structure of the day.
Well, when Davy got to Washington, he was from one of the farthest west districts that there was. He was in far west Tennessee. Representing largely a poor constituency of farmers, who some of whom were squatters who didn't actually own their land. And he was coming into Washington at a time when the frontier was what was happening in America. And there were lots of legends about it. There were lots of stereotypes about it. But it was also a huge source of energy. And so he's coming into an Eastern establishment where most people don't talk or sound like him. And he comes to represent the frontier. He's a little bit of a curiosity. Some people make fun of him. Other people glorify him as the great frontiersman, all of which contributes to a kind of an unearned celebrity. He's a famous person without having, again, actually accomplished much politically. And that's really one of the first times that happened. You think of other people like Ben Franklin who were famous for their personalities, but Franklin was an enormously important figure in the American Revolution, which that's a claim Crockett can't make. So he had to deal with this. To some extent, he had created his own frontiersman image as a way of selling himself to voters, that he was just like them and not like those toffs in even the Tennessee state government. But when he got to Washington, that got a little bit out of his control, because his friends built him up as a heroic, honest frontiersman, and his enemies mocked him as an illiterate, rude frontiersman. And that dynamic continued throughout his time in Congress.
So essentially he was trying to be something that's very difficult to be in Congress today, which is an independent, right, without the influence of other larger forces. But the Tennessee delegation was a pretty powerful delegation back at the time. And James Polk, I understand, was the unofficial or official delegation leader. Andrew Jackson was on his way to becoming president or close to it.
Yes.
And Davy had conflicts with that power structure.
Well, Davy, I'm calling him Davy just because we know him as Davy. He was David at that time. But he, although his celebrity persona began to make him into Davy, he started out as a Jackson man. He'd served under Jackson in the war. He'd seen some things about him that he didn't like, but he didn't play that up politically. He was a good Jackson Democrat. But when he got to Congress, the specific thing that he most wanted to get done was to pass a land bill that would guarantee the title to land for his constituents who had been working it. It's a very complicated story, but a lot of them did not have title to their land, and he wanted to get it for them. And he at first tried to do that working with the Jackson Democrats under Polk, who had a somewhat different idea about how to do it. But when that didn't work, he went his own way. And in the process of going his own way, he made alliances with Jackson's enemies. It's actually really, there's no real parallel today because parties are so much more regimented. But even then, he was off the reservation. And he made the Tennessee Democrats furious with him. And he never actually called himself a Whig, which is what the other party eventually came to be called. He never renounced his original allegiance to the Democrats, but in effect, he became a Whig.
and an anti-Jacksonian of some note.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but his anti-Jackson fervor sort of reached a peak when he decided to, as I understand it, vote against Jackson's Indian removal bill, which of course resulted in the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee being moved to Oklahoma. I mean, here's David Crockett, who fought alongside Jackson in the military, fought the Indians. Why did he vote against Jackson's Indian removal bill?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and it's not clear that we have the answer. One of the things to say about the Indian removal bill is that it was true that he voted against it, and it was true that that was a really brave and independent thing for him to do, and it cost him politically. But because the land bill question is so complicated and people usually leave it out of the popular narratives, the Indian vote gets exaggerated. It did not, in fact, end his congressional career. He lost one election, but then he was reelected after that. But just to get back to the vote itself, it could have been a matter of principle. In which he believed that the Indians were getting an extremely raw deal, which was absolutely true. It could have been also that he was in alliance with a bunch of anti-Jackson politicians from the Northwest, who hated the Indian bill for their own reasons and hated Jackson. So there was a natural alliance there. He knew that his constituents were in favor of Indian removal. There's no question about that. And he voted against it anyway, which in historical retrospect was a courageous and correct thing to do. It was also a close vote. So if a couple other people had joined him from the Tennessee delegation, which wasn't going to happen, but if just a few other votes had turned, they would have not passed the bill. So very courageous moment, not sure what complex of circumstances made him go that way, but I would say a combination of them.
So Crockett loses re-election to Congress. He's sort of under the fray back in Tennessee for a few months, or about 18 months or 2 years, and then he's re-elected to Congress again. When he comes back to D.C., things are a little bit different. He sort of takes control of his own destiny and begins to invent through words and through portraits his own mythology, sort of capitalizing on that frontiersman mentality. Talk about that. How was Davy different when he arrived in Washington a second time?
Well, he definitely it was different, and definitely his image was built. It's not quite right that he was doing it himself at that point, because what happened when he came back, while he was out of office, the first thing that happened was that someone wrote a play about him. They didn't call him Crockett in the play, but it was a character clearly based on Crockett. It was a very popular play. It was a very it was a frontier character. And actually, not long after Crockett got back to Congress, there was a performance in Washington where the actor came out on stage in his frontiersman outfit with his furry hat, and Crockett was in the audience, and they bowed to each other. So Crockett knew that he was participating in this. The other thing that happened was that there was an unauthorized biography that came out of Crockett around the same time that he was getting back to Congress. And when I say unauthorized, what I mean is that Crockett didn't like it, and it was published anonymously. But he was clearly the source for some of the information. But it, too, made him into a larger-than-life figure, sometimes comic, sometimes heroic. And as a result of that, he wrote his own autobiography. He didn't like the way that the other guy had portrayed him, so he wrote his own. And after he wrote his autobiography, he went on what was probably the first American political book tour. And it was both politics and a book tour. His friends, the anti-Jacksonians, invited him to tour the northeastern states, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. And he would give these rabble-rousing speeches denouncing Andrew Jackson, and this was great publicity for his book. This was the peak of his fame, at least prior to the time he got to San Antonio, and he was enormously visible as an American character at that time.
So what happened when he wasn't reelected to Congress? He lost to his rival, Adam Huntsman, who evidently had a wooden leg. This is where Davy
yes.
is quoted saying, "Since you have chosen to elect a man with a timber toe to succeed me, you may all go to hell and I'll go to Texas."
Yeah.
Why did things fall apart for David Crockett in Washington, D.C.?
Well, he's been trying to push this land bill, and he never really comes that close, but the closest he comes is early on. And so every year he tries again, and every year he gets less close, and that's the one thing he's promised his constituents. He did not promise them to vote against Indian removal. He promised them that he would get a land bill passed. Meanwhile, he has aggravated the Jackson forces severely, so they are trying hard to get him defeated because they're tired of him. They're tired of his independence and not following their lead. But he's also he's this enormously famous man, so he's got to figure out what to do next. And when he gets defeated, he is bitter about the defeat. He believes he's been cheated. He's not happy at all. But on some level, I think he's relieved because he was getting pretty sick of being in Congress and getting nothing done. And at the time, Texas was the new frontier. He at that time was living in very far western Tennessee, and the movement at that point for those folks was southwest through Arkansas and on into Texas, which was under Mexican control, but which was welcoming American settlers. And so this is a new chance for him. He left as the Texas Rebellion against Mexico was just getting started. He probably didn't know about it at the time he left. He learned about it on his way, but that's not why he went. He went for new opportunity and possibly to reinvigorate a political career under new circumstances. He said a couple things on his trip about how he expected to end up in the Texas legislature. But in any case, he needed a new start. And so many people who went to Texas, as you know, needed that new start.
He traveled to Texas via Nacogdoches in East Texas and then on through to the Alamo. When he got to the Alamo, did he know what he was in for?
He did not. Let me back up for a little bit because his trip through Texas is really kind of wonderful. He does end up going through Nacogdoches, but he wanders around northeast Texas for a month or two before that. And he is having what sounds like a fabulous time. He's exploring territory that is unfamiliar to him. He's hunting. He's meeting people. He's in no hurry whatsoever to get on to his next stop. So there's a shortening of the Crockett legend that says, well, he left Tennessee to go fight in the Alamo. But what he actually said was he wanted to go explore Texas, and he did. And so he ended up in what are now tiny towns like Honey Grove, Texas, which claims that it derives its name from a grove of trees with a lot of bees in them that Crockett discovered. I think that's probably not the case, but it's a lovely town. And he's wandering, and he gets to Nacogdoches, and that's where he runs into the people being serious about the fight with Mexico, and that's where he enlists. Again, he enlists a combination of reasons. He was a very strong believer in Republican government, small R Republican. He very much believed that, and so this was a good cause for him to fight for. But he also knew that military credentials at the time, as they are still, were an important part of a political career. And if he was going to launch a political career in Texas, he needed to sign up and help out. So he did.
And was he promised a certain amount of land for his service in the Texan Army if everything panned out?
You know, I don't know that he directly was promised that, but pretty much people who volunteered were going to get some land either cheaply or free. It was an accepted part. A lot of the people who fought were volunteers. There's a crazy situation where they had both a volunteer army and a regular army, but for a large part of the conflict, the volunteers dominated, and so it was likely that they would be rewarded with land.
Did you learn anything about Davy Crockett's sort of sense of hierarchy inside the Alamo during the siege, during those 13 days? So he was referred to as Colonel Crockett. Of course, William Travis was the commander, and it appears that there were some conflicts between he and Bowie, but where did Crockett sort of sit on the hierarchical military ladder while the siege was going on?
Well, let me start by saying that our information about what happened inside the Alamo when the siege was going on is extremely limited. And what we know about Crockett's military status is that when he came to town, when he first rode in, he was apparently, there was some talk about making him one of the commanders, but he waved it off. He said he wanted to serve as what he called a high private, and so he had no formal command. Most people who portray him inside the Alamo and who write about it believe that he was a very powerful personality in the leadership informally, just because of who he was. He was by far the most famous man there. Bowie and Travis are very famous now, but they were moderately well-known in Texas at the time. But Crockett was nationally and even internationally famous. So that carried with it a lot of informal power. But the real answer is we don't know, because most of them died.
And we really don't know how Crockett met his demise in the final moments of the siege. There are some people who believe he was shot and killed. Other people believe he was captured and executed by Santa Anna's forces. There's even a rumor out there that he begged for his life. But that's really not what you found.
Well, this is one of the most complicated chapters in the book. And I had an enormous amount of fun writing it. But then at the end of it, I had to decide what I thought. And let me start by saying is that we don't know, and we probably will never know. There are basically two schools, one of which is that he died fighting, as most of the men did. The other is that he and five or six other guys were captured and executed after the battle. Now, when we say captured, we don't necessarily mean surrendered, although they could have surrendered. They could have been asked to surrender by a Mexican general, which is one version of the story. And we certainly don't mean beg for their lives. That there's a very specific derivation of that, and it's doubtful. But in any case, you have these two options, died fighting, captured and executed. Both of those versions were circulated at the time, shortly thereafter. In other words, it's not there was an explosion of interest in this in the 1970s, but it was a little startling when that happened because both versions had been out there. But naturally, when you have a heroic figure, it's more likely that the percentage of stories will involve him dying a heroic death. And while I don't think there is anything dishonorable about the executions, except to the Mexicans who chose to do that. When a new source was revealed in the 1970s that favored the execution theory and specified that Crockett had been one of the men executed, there was this huge outburst from people who didn't want to believe that. And it's a fascinating dispute.
Bob Thompson is the author of the new book, Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. We have to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. Our guest is Bob Thompson. He's the author of the book Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. Bob, before the break, we were in the final moments of the Battle of the Alamo discussing the different theories about Davy Crockett's demise. I want to move to a wonderful part of the book now where you talk about the way Davy's myth evolved in the 20th century. And it really took off in the 1950s when Walt Disney decided to cast Fess Parker as the King of the Wild Frontier. What attracted Walt Disney to the figure of Davy Crockett? And obviously he wasn't a perfect guy, but what attracted Disney to that figure, and how did that relationship blossom?
Well, Davy Crockett became that Disney character by accident in some ways. Disney had a theme park that he was trying to get built. He'd in Southern California, the first Disneyland. He had done a deal with ABC Television to produce a show that would largely help him promote his theme park. And one of the segments of that show was Frontierland, so he needed frontier characters. And his team came up with a list of possibilities. Among them, I think Daniel Boone and Johnny Appleseed, and somebody who intrigued me named Bigfoot Wallace. He was a Texas Ranger who I think is known pretty well in Texas, but not necessarily outside. But they didn't pick Bigfoot; they picked Davy for reasons that are not entirely clear. And when they picked him, then the question became who was going to play him. And this is a story that I really love. They trotted out a bunch of famous actors, and they went through them and thought about various possibilities. And one of them was James Arness, who later became famous as the central figure on Gunsmoke. But Arness was playing in a science fiction movie called Them, which was about giant mutant ants attacking people in the New Mexico desert. And one of the people who had a bit part in that movie was Fess Parker Jr., who was a starving actor who was trying to make it and had not done so. He has about a 3 or 4 minute part in which he's seen the ants and been locked up in a mental ward because nobody believes him. And James Arness beautiful scientist colleague come and interview Fess Parker, and he kind of storms around the screen in his bathrobe telling the story. And the studio legend has it that when Disney saw that, he said, "That's our Davy Crockett," and that's the way it worked. And he turned out to be a superb choice for Crockett, although his director didn't think that. But there was something about his persona that just clicked with this all-American heroic Southern figure. He had the right kind of little drawl, and he was well-mannered and funny, and it just clicked. They had no idea it was going to be a huge hit.
And how did it affect Fess Parker's career over time? I mean, that was the role of his career, wasn't it?
It was absolutely the role of his career, although he replicated it in a way. He wanted to do it again. He wanted to play Davy again, and the Disney folks wouldn't let him. So he eventually did a deal with NBC, and they did a number of years of Parker playing Daniel Boone, wearing a coonskin cap and looking exactly like Davy Crockett and pretty much behaving like him, too. But in between, Parker was a huge star after the Disney thing. The whole country became obsessed with Crockett, and that's it went on for most of a year. And all of my generation were caught up in it. But in the meantime, Parker had signed a contract with Disney, a sort of personal services contract as an actor. And that meant that Disney controlled what he could and couldn't do. And he was offered a role playing with Marilyn Monroe in Bus Stop. And Disney told him he didn't think that was a good idea for him. It wouldn't be good for his image. And John Ford offered him the role playing John Wayne's nephew in The Searchers, which is often called the greatest Western of all time. A friend of mine, Glenn Frankel, has just written an excellent book about it called The Searchers. And Disney didn't even tell Parker that he'd been offered that part. And it went to a man named Robert Hunter. And so he was trapped in the role of Davy Crockett, essentially, Davy Crockett slash Daniel Boone. And eventually he bailed out of show business and became a successful in real estate, and he had a winery in Santa Barbara that was quite successful and is still there.
The other great Davy Crockett that comes to mind, of course, is John Wayne in the film The Alamo, which I believe he directed.
Yes.
And I, of course, you know, John Wayne was influenced a lot by his relationship with John Ford on this film. But how did John Wayne evolve the role, the cinematic role of Davy Crockett, taking what he knew from Fess Parker and from his work with John Ford? How did he make that role his own?
Well, he did not. One of the things he did was he tried not to be Fess Parker. He didn't. He wore a coonskin cap, but he took it off a lot. He didn't wear it that much because that was really the Fess Parker brand. And he played Crockett as a more shrewd, calculating, somewhat troubled man. But the real thing that happened in the John Wayne movie is that John Wayne played Crockett as, to some extent, John Wayne. It was impossible for him to avoid that. He's an enormous screen presence. He had millions of fans who saw him as the John Wayne hero. So all of a sudden you have this movie which is not very faithful to the Alamo story in its details, and you have a Crockett who is overwhelmingly John Wayne. So I really liked Wayne's performance. I couldn't take my eyes off him when I was watching the film, but I never really believed he was Crockett. He did not seem like Davy.
And then we move to, I guess, the most recent incarnation of Davy Crockett is the 2004 film starring Billy Bob Thornton as Crockett. And the filmmakers, it appears, attempt to do reflect a lot of history as it happens. The scene that you mentioned earlier in the show about Crockett being at the performance of the play where the character nods to him and he nods to the audience, that scene opens the film.
Yes.
There are a couple of references about how Crockett likes to be referred to as David, not Davy. And yeah. And if you look at the portrait, the famous portrait that was done of Crockett in Washington, D.C., Billy Bob Thornton looks a lot like the authentic Davy Crockett. What did you think of Billy Bob Thornton's performance? The film, of course, was a flop, a box office flop, but it continues to be the most recent representation that we have of Crockett's incarnation at the Alamo.
Well, it was a box office flop. They tried very hard to make it more accurate than previous Alamo films, especially Wayne's. And they succeeded in that, although I have some irrelevant bones to pick with the part about Sam Houston. But Billy Bob Thornton's Crockett was tremendously evocative. And my problem with it is that he's full of angst about his image. He knows that he's Davy Crockett, quote unquote, not really David, because he's got this tremendous image. He knows that this controls him in some way, and he thinks about that a lot and talks about it a little in the movie. I don't think it's unreasonable that Crockett was aware of his image, but he was a man who was much looser and more humorous, and I just don't think he was as filled with that kind of brooding. But when you mention that portrait, I want to go back and tell a story about that, because it's about the real Crockett, but it also shows his relationship with celebrity in a kind of a wonderful way. This happened in 1834, right after he came off his book tour in the Northeast, and he was asked to sit for a portrait by a man whose name I'm blanking on at the moment, but Chapman, I believe. And Chapman did a pretty standard bust portrait of him, the head and shoulders, which is actually now owned by the Alamo, and which I like very much. But David didn't like it. He said it made him look just like all the others. It made him look like half politician, half Methodist minister. And he said to Chapman, "Why don't you try painting me on a bear hunt in the canebrakes in Tennessee with some dogs and hunting clothes and a rifle?" And Chapman was pretty intrigued with him, so he played along. And they went out and shopped all over Washington for equipment because Crockett didn't bring any of his hunting clothes to Washington. So he had to borrow a hunting jacket and he had to borrow a rifle. And they had to find some hunting dogs, which David insisted that they be mongrels, that they not be purebred dogs. He said you could go out and find them outside Washington at any county fair. So what you have is the one image. There are no photographs of Crockett, and all of the other portraits are of him in what he in his congressman clothes, as he put it. And so this is the one portrait of him in an outdoor setting, and it is completely staged. It is David knowing that this is his frontier image and wanting to express it. That doesn't mean he didn't want to express the truth of it as well, but it's just a wonderful illustration of the position he was in between his real self and his celebrity frontiersman self. And that kind of celebrity stuff, we're a lot more familiar with that today, but the sort of clash between people's real lives and their celebrity images. But just the extent to which Crockett knew exactly what he was doing when he created that portrait. There's a way in which I'm arguing against my own thesis about Billy Bob there, because again, Billy Bob Thornton's Crockett is very conscious of his image. And I did like his performance very much, but I think that Crockett was a little looser and probably told a few more jokes.
You talk about celebrity and culture sort of clashing with history, and you end your journey, of course, in Alamo Plaza in San Antonio, which is really kind of the manifestation of the cinematic Davy Crockett meeting the historical Davy Crockett. If for our listeners who haven't been to Alamo Plaza, it's not the solemn shrine that people make it out to be. I mean, of course, the church itself and the grounds of the Alamo are considered a shrine, but there's a lot going on around Alamo Plaza. Could you give our listeners who haven't been there a sense of what you saw when you walked into Alamo Plaza for the first time? And I want to let our listeners know you were there for the 175th anniversary of the fall of the Alamo.
Yes, and I had been there once before that, but when I walked in for the 175th, first of all, I checked into my hotel, and there was a giant portrait of David on the wall of the hotel, which had been done as part of a movie project that never got made. It's kind of a wonderful reenactment of what he must have looked like in his 20s before we have any actual images of him. Then I walked over to Alamo Plaza and immediately saw a man in a coonskin cap and full regalia, who turned out to be Crockett's great 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 grandson. Do I have that right? I think that's right. It might be one too many greats in there, but anyways, in any case, he was a direct descendant, and we chatted for a while, and he gave me his business card. The plaza was full of tourists. Across the street, there are all kinds of hokey tourist traps, which are there because the Alamo is across the street from them. And yet, you also have this iconic building, which carries with it all of this resonance about the last stand that those guys made there. And so you have this wonderful mix of sort of almost carnival atmosphere and reverent history. There's still a little sign outside the door of the Alamo Church, which is the principal building that survives.
Bob, we only have about a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt. Sure. I just want to come back in real quick. You talk about the solemn nature of the shrine. Of course, you have to remove your hat. You can feel the ghosts inside there. But then you walk into the Alamo gift shop, and it's a little bit different in there, isn't it?
It is. It's not very surprising, but you have bins of coonskin caps, and it's a highly commercial enterprise. And it seems to me that that's kind of fitting for Davy Crockett, because he is an authentic American frontier hero, heroic in particular because of what happened at the Alamo. And he is also an authentic American movie star, based on his afterlife, created largely by Walt Disney. And those two things are completely inseparable these days. You can't distinguish.
Bob Thompson, his new book is called Born on a Mountaintop, On the Road with Davy Crockett and the Ghosts of the Wild Frontier. He joined us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction today from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. Doug Fabrizio is the executive producer. I'm Terry Gilday.